Hello and welcome to edition 406 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Tom Edwards.
On this week's programme, we'll be talking to the writer, comedian and broadcaster David Baddiel. He'll be telling us how his unlikely family story has become the inspiration of his new stage show, My Family, Not the Sitcom.
And we'll be speaking to sculptor Kristen Visbal, the woman whose Fearless Girl artwork in New York has got the city talking. And we'll also be talking about it a little more with the art critic Francesca Gavin.
And staying in New York, we'll also learn the story of activist Jane Jacobs, the subject of new documentary Citizen Jane, The Battle for the City. The film's makers, journalist Matt Turnauer and Robert Hammond, co-founder of New York's Highline Park, will be with us later.
Plus, Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan will be fighting his own one-man personal battle that is the weekly news look ahead. Do pray for him. We'll play some music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Well, Steve, another week bites the dust, as I say so often when sat here on a Sunday lunchtime in London town. How was the last 7 days for you? You've not joined me in the Monocle Weekly chair for some time.
No, I know. It's been a while. It's been you and
like
Mr. Tuck and Mr.
Me.
Bound and Mr. Tuck. Well, you know, it's because I get to see you so often.
Do you have better things to be doing
every
weekend?
Day opposite a desk? So I feel I don't need to come down here and chat.
And you've been up to your elbows in nappies and baby effluent for a few weeks as well, haven't you?
Are we allowed to talk babies on Walker Weekly?
I think you can mention baby effluent anytime you like.
I have, yes.
You smell, you smell as fragrant as ever, though, Steve. Don't worry.
Thank you very much.
Now, what are you looking forward to today? Light and shade. We've got art. We've got urbanism. We've got
more art.
Dark comedy. More art. Everywhere in between.
I am looking forward to, and I kid you not, everything we're going to be doing, aside from Henry, but everything we're going to be doing. Because, so David Baddiel is, for those who are not British, he might be a new name, a new voice, but he was one of the huge alternative comedy stars here in the 1990s, along with Rob Newman. He sort of established alternative comedy and was also one of the driving forces in making football a more middle-class sport, it could be argued. He's going to be very interesting. And also it's going to be very good to speak to Matt Turnauer as well about the Jane Jacobs documentary. He's written for us before. I think for it was either The Forecast or The Escapist. I should remember because I commissioned him. but it was a great essay that he wrote about the battle between Jane Jacobs and Robert Moses.
I can't wait. On with the show. But as you mentioned, Steve, it can't all be 5-star Oscar-winning material.
No, we need some sort of...
Every now and again, the
3-star.
Show...
3-star. It's 3-star.
The show loses its luster 2-star. Here and there. Let's see if we can buff Henry Rhys Sheridan up to a high shine. Henry Rhys Sheridan is here.
Hi, Tom.
Steve, there's
hi.
A bit of a pause there, wasn't there?
Well, I don't know. It's a fraught relationship at this stage, isn't it?
Let's be honest. It was a sort of Beckett-esque drama.
What?
Pregnant pauses, that kind of thing.
So Beckett was... Okay, never mind. Let's not do this now.
Wasted breath.
How are you doing, Henry?
Very well, Steve. Thank you very much. How are you?
I'm all right.
Good.
I'm all right.
Good.
I'm enjoying the fact... You know what? People say working on a Sunday is, you know... Not ideal, but you know, when it's with such fine gentlemen as you two.
It's not work. Look across at the glinting eyes of Henry Rhys Sheridan.
I know.
That's not work, is it?
When he's got his news look ahead look in his eyes.
And
it's almost as if he is looking ahead to the news over
his
the horizon.
Don
over
your
my
news,
shoulder.
Look ahead, Trilby, and tell us what the first story is, Henry.
On the 17th of April, the annual White House Easter egg roll is taking place on the South Lawn. Do either of you know what this is?
I
didn't until I researched this.
I do.
The clue's
also,
in the name.
Can I also say, I like the fact that you emphasised white in that, which then sort of made it sound a bit weird, as if he was like, what's he talking about? Oh, the White House. Okay. He was like, White House. Sounds a bit strange. Anyway.
I need to work on my stresses.
Yeah, yeah. I know what this is. It's this annual event where loads of kids come to the White House. The First Lady usually oversees it. Am I right in thinking there's some controversy this year, Henry?
Like so many things with this administration, Steve, the build-up to this event has been fraught with controversy. So the planning, apparently, was extremely late, to the extent that the company that fabricates of the wooden eggs which the children are meant to hunt for on the South Lawn of the White House, actually tweeted at Donald Trump to remind him to put his order in before the window, the manufacturing window closed.
Oh, it's brilliant.
And it had to do that multiple times they actually made the order. There are serious concerns about understaffing at the White House and the fact that they don't have a live-in First Lady who would be the person who normally oversees this event. So it's been scaled back quite considerably. They are having one, but there are going to be fewer volunteers, fewer attendees, and fewer Sesame Street characters, Steve.
Ah, yes, more controversy. I know about this.
Only one emissary, as the New York Times put it from the show, is going.
Who's coming?
I don't know. I think it's going to be a surprise. It's got to be the Big E, doesn't it? Let's be honest.
It could be Big Bird. You never know. But yes, there's some controversy over this because obviously Donald Trump has suggested slashing funding for PBS, of which Sesame Street was where it was made originally. And obviously some of the people connected to Sesame Street have said, you know what, if you're going to cut off our funding or the funding of our founders, then you can't then use this as window dressing for your Easter egg thingy.
You think Elmo's going to be put through a particularly rigorous security check this year, Steve?
Extreme vetting.
Extreme vetting for
Sounds
Elmo.
Sounds a bit foreign. Probably shouldn't be let in.
So that's happening. Let's hope at least that the child participants in that event have a good time. It's not their fault that Donald Trump's president. On the 23rd...
No, it's their parents.
...of April, the London Marathon is taking place.
Have you done this, Tom?
The London Marathon?
Yeah.
Yeah, several times.
Really?
Let's have some anecdotes, Tom. Let's have some marathon anecdotes.
I don't know if I can say some of the things that really burned into my memory.
Are you joking?
Was it pain?
No, not personal. I saw some things.
Really?
My single most abiding memory was running through one of the underpasses when you were coming back from the Isle of Dogs. And there was somebody, a runner, in a bit of difficulty. You know, it can play havoc with your internal pipes. And he was, I can only say, emptying himself.
Yeah, I imagine that you couldn't tear your eyes away like a car crash.
You can't unsee that.
No, but thanks for giving that image to us.
I must say, it sped me to the finish. I did the second half of the race in about one measured hour after that.
On the 19th of April, National Garlic Day is taking place.
Is it every day National Garlic Day?
I think this is national to the United Kingdom.
Yes, sir.
thoughts on garlic? Knowledge of garlic? I'd be up for some.
It's one of those things that has incredible magic properties, isn't it? It's like honey, other things like that.
Cultivated for many thousands of years, used both medicinally and in a culinary capacity.
And prevents you being killed by a vampire.
Most importantly, perhaps. That's got to fall into the medicinal kind of pot.
But it should be
charms.
In most meals, frankly.
No, I feel strongly about that too. I don't think you can have enough garlic. Some people feel very strongly the other way.
Do you know what? I like a whole roasted garlic.
I'll have a whole clove.
And just break it open and just gobble that up with your Sunday roast.
If you're going to have a Sunday roast, you do have to roast some garlics in it.
Just throw a few garlics in there.
Would you ever have cloves just on their own?
Yeah.
Really?
I like it when
like a hand fruit.
I like it when they're preserved somewhat. You know, maybe in, for example, a small jar of olives. Yep. You get the little peppers and the pickled garlics. Just chuck them back. Crunch them up.
But so just to be clear, you wouldn't eat raw garlic on its own, would you?
I've tried it.
What happened?
I was quite fragrant.
Is this the light ender, or have you got a really serious story to finish on following the discussion about garlic?
Normally there'll be some kind of war crimes tribunal or something.
Yeah, no, I thought I'd end it on Garlic Day.
Okay, no, that's fine,
Is that
good.
Okay?
No. Henry, we challenged you to bring a bit of luster back to your performance. You did fail, but you gave it a good shot. Thanks for being on the Monocle Weekly.
4 out of 10. David Baddiel has been known to UK TV viewers for the past 30 years for his trademark droll humour and wit, delivered across shows ranging from straight-up comedy to panel shows and documentaries. He's also written novels and was also one half of the nation's footballing public conscience with fellow comic Frank Skinner.
Baddiel's latest project is My Family, Not the Sitcom, a show currently at London's Playhouse Theatre, which draws on David's family and upbringing for its source material. As you might imagine, converting the realities of family life into comic entertainment is not always an effortless transition. David joins us now to tell us more about it. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, David.
Thank you.
Good to have you. I guess that's something of an understatement, isn't it, talking about the transition of the intricacies, the inner workings, the secrets of family life to comedy.
Well, yes and no, I think. I mean, sorry to interrupt, but...
That's what you're here for.
No, I just think, in and of itself, family might seem like quite a soft subject because, you know, talking about, I don't know, changing nappies or, you know, making your wife a cup of tea in the morning, that's fairly light observational comedy. But what I'm talking about is the fact that my late mother had an affair for most of the time that we were teenagers and then beyond, and my dad has dementia. So it is totally about family and about the intricacies of family, but I come at it through subjects that I think people would think of as dark subjects. But the weird thing is, having said all that, I think the overall sense of my show, even though it goes into some pretty bleak areas, is it's kind of a feel-good show. It tries to find a way of being kind of feel-good and upbeat by going into some of the more complicated and difficult areas of family life.
How comfortable were you with the idea, when you first had the idea, of actually sharing your family story with us?
Entirely comfortable. The only discomfort I had was how my brothers might feel about it, because I have no discomfort, literally none. At one point in the show, I talk about having most of the show, about 70% of it is about my mother's affair, about 30% of it is about my dad's dementia, although the whole show is sort of about memory, about how you remember people. And one thing I said about my mother, because one of the key elements of the show is my mother was not ashamed of her affair. She was very, very proud of it. And that's a key thing that sort of gives me license to talk about it.
And, while it was going on?
Oh, unbelievably. I mean, if she met you, she'd be telling you within 15 seconds. She would like the look of you. You're a nice... You could be Jewish. I don't know if you're Jewish or not.
Either way, I am, yes.
Yeah, it wouldn't matter, really. She'd like the look of you. She'd think, I must tell this nice-looking boy about my affair. Because she thought it was glamorous. And it's a very 70s thing at some level, is that for her, having an affair with a golfing memorabilia salesman was, you know, in her mind, the nearest she could get to whatever Gloria Steinem and Susan Sontag were doing in New York in terms of the sexual revolution. So she was proud of it and she was very keen to broadcast it. But my point was, I suppose, in terms of your question about difficulty, was my mum has passed something on to me, which is a very deep lack of shame. And I genuinely kind of don't have the gene for shame. There's almost nothing about me or my background that I feel, as long as it is transmutable into comedy, I don't have a sense of, like, oh, I shouldn't be saying this. If anything, the opposite. I really want to say it. So the only people I was worried about was my brothers. And they both said, don't do it.
And here we are.
Well, what I did was, actually, my older brother, I've not actually said this to anyone. My older brother, who I'm very close to, Ivor, sat me down and said, look, because I sort of brought him to my house and said, let's have a long chat about this. And he said, before we have the long chat, can I say something? Are you going to do it whatever? And I said, yes. I said, whatever we say now in this conversation, I am going to do it. So he said, well, fine, just do the show. I will trust you that even though I am not comfortable with you doing it, I'll trust you that when I see it, you know, the tone and the feel of it, whatever, will come from a place that will make it okay. And that is what happened. When he saw the show, he said, I loved it. And then he said something which actually made me kind of fill up on stage. And this was the opening night at the Chocolate Factory, which was the first run of the show in South London. He said, I loved it because it felt like she, my mother, it felt like she was in the room. And that made me go a bit because I thought, yes, this is partly what it's about. It's partly about... the show begins by talking about how at her funeral, everyone told me that my mother was wonderful. And my reaction to that was, don't say that. That erases her out of existence. All you can say about someone is that they're wonderful after they're gone. You may as well say nothing. What you need to call up are their weirdnesses and their madnesses and their flaws, because that is what brings them back to life.
But we rarely do that at funerals, don't we? Or in fact, even afterwards.
We don't do it at funerals. And also we don't do it about people with dementia. That's the other thing, is that once a person has a disease like that, dementia, cancer, whatever, life-threatening disease, again, they become an angel. But my point about that is an erasure of their basic humanity. And certainly they're not funny anymore. And my mum was hilarious. I mean, often without meaning to be, but she was absolutely hilarious. And my brother has said to me, actually, that he's seen the show like four times now, that when he comes to see it, having not seen it for a while, he realises how he hasn't thought about my mother. That's what happens, obviously, with death. You just stop thinking about someone at some level. That's how the pain goes. But I sort of live with her every night. And so, in a way, she hasn't gone. She's still there for me, because the show does very much bring her to life because it's so idiosyncratic about what a nutter she was.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that ongoing process of learning that I guess you continue to go through as you perform the piece. Does it change each day? Do you learn new things? Is there fresh memories that are summoned? Is it more about your own learning about your memories or your relationship with your brothers? I mean, does it evolve in a gradual way?
Yeah, it evolves sometimes in a very, very mechanical way, because I find out stuff through doing the show, i.e. people who have known my parents come to the show. There was an intensely dramatic moment in the last night, or I think that maybe the penultimate night, at the Vaudeville Theatre, which was the run before. One thing I talk about in the show is the fact that when my mum, this is a very key thing because the show is also about identity, when my mum was born, she wasn't called Sarah, that's what my mum's name was, she was called Fromit. And the reason she was called Fromit is my mum was born in Nazi Germany and you had to choose the name of your baby after 1938 if you were Jewish from a government-prescribed list. And all the names on this list were shit. And Fromit was like the best of the bad bunch. I mean, incredible names, like there's a name called Gielchen on it that means slut, for example. It's unbelievable. I've got the list, I talk quite a lot about this. Anyway, it's a sort of running gag, running echo throughout the show, this name of my mother's and what it meant and how I see her whole life at some level as a victory over that name. But then, in the encore, a bloke who's about 70 stands up in the balcony and reads a letter that he wrote when he was 15 to his parents. It turned out he lodged with my grandparents in Cambridge, and in the letter it says, I can hear little Fromit saying her prayers. And it's unbelievable for me, because I've never heard her described by that name, you know, sort of in the wild, as it were. I always called her Sarah. She hated that name because the Nazis had given it to her. So it was sort of unbelievably chilling and moving at the same time. So in terms of your question, yes, it evolves because I find stuff out like that.
Do you feel that you've then sort of learnt more about yourself from doing this show?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know...
So it's quite a trite question. But
no, it's not a trite question. It's not a trite question. It's a good question. I'm just trying to think how to answer it because I don't want to go into a cliche. And the cliche I'm trying not to go into is stand-up as therapy. Because I was in therapy for 10 years. And trust me, I'm happy doing stand-up, not least financially. but it isn't just therapy. And to describe it as therapy is slightly trite. It obviously has a therapeutic element to it because I do think, and again, this is a cliche, but I think this is true, that laughter is to some extent healing. That I think, obviously, there's a lot of complicated and difficult elements here, not least my mum is dead and my dad has dementia, that I am transforming into something which I think is good, which is laughter. So that is healing. I think that I probably didn't realise when I first started to put the show together how much my mother's death, which happened very suddenly, had not been, and again, this is a very therapy word, but processed by me. She died really suddenly, and I don't know if you've had any death in your life, but one of the things that happens that you don't realise is just the sheer absence of someone, if it happens quickly, is very shocking. You know, you sort of come, I remember my brother saying to me, it seems ridiculous that we won't ever see her again for the rest of our life. It does. And that seemed the right word. It seems preposterous that someone so in your life cannot be. So I think it was partly a way of doing that, sort of processing it and drawing out that absence so that I could get over it. And I don't think I did realise that when I started doing it.
And Dave, with your dad's dementia, I mean, this is an unbelievably complex thing to deal with. And it is like it's like a really long, drawn out process of bereavement, but they're still around. And in a way, society's been far slower even to come to terms with that than it has with bereavement, with the loss of people through death. You've become sort of more involved in people who, in charities that work in this area and stuff. I mean, presumably that's quite important. Is that partly because the scale of the challenge for you and the rest of your family, was that almost equally shocking as this sort of reality has dawned over, because it's over a fair amount of time?
Yeah. Well, the charities thing is just something that happens, to be honest. You do stuff about a subject like that and charities want you involved.
Did you mind about that?
No, I don't mind at all. I'll be honest with you, I don't see it as the focus of what I do. I want to do comedy about it because I'm a comedian and I have always done...
Do you think, did they get that?
Yeah. Oh, no, they love that because they want new conversations. They really, people like the Alzheimer's Society or the rare brain disorders people, or all these different people that now want me to be involved, they really just want to open up the conversation and have more people talking about it. And so they don't mind and are pleased that someone is doing it in whatever way, and particularly, I guess, in an entertaining way. But the truth is that there's an enormous silence about it, about this incredibly big thing, which is that more and more people have it and more people are surviving with it. And I really, part of what I wanted to do was just shift the conversation a bit, because my experience of dementia was not that my dad was just sitting staring at a wall with a blanket over his knees saying nothing. He was doing the opposite in a way. He was becoming what I describe in the show as a sort of spitting image puppet of himself. My dad had always been this incredibly sweary, curmudgeonly, difficult, angry bloke, and suddenly it was times 20 because he had Pick's disease, which is a frontal lobe dementia. And actually, other members of my family have had breakdowns. And one of the things my brother said, I remember, is that when people break down, they often break down in their own way. And I started to think, oh, perhaps my father is having dementia in his own way, because what he's becoming is this extreme version of himself, sort of unbelievably antisocial and angry and sort of inappropriate and whatever. And there's comedy in that. I mean, very dark comedy, but definitely comedy.
As you say, you have more people now living with dementia. Mm. And you know, if you look back, I know, sort of 80, 90 years, when people would live until, if they lived until their early 60s, they were doing quite well. Yeah. And, you know, you might get a pension for like 1 or 2 years. Now we're at a stage where people can retire and they might have 30 years as a pensioner. And also medicine's improved so much.
Yeah.
We're going to be, more of us are going to be living in this way and might have 10, 15, 20 years where we're quite ill, but not going to die.
Yeah, but and also a lot of us, I mean, really a lot of us, will be living with relatives.
Yes,
exactly. Who we have to support and care for, which is the situation I'm in and a lot of people of my generation are in.
But we don't know how to do that yet, do we?
Well, we certainly don't know exactly how to do it emotionally. Also, the care system generally can't cope with it. I mean, just in the case of my dad, we did begin by trying to get him into a care home after my mum died, because my mum was his primary carer, going to care home, saying he's a bit challenging, actually, and them saying, oh, don't worry, we're used to it. They would then come around and interview him. He would say, fuck off, you cunts, over and over again, and then they would run away, scared. So in the end, we thought, we can't get him into a care home, what are we going to do? And we now have 24-hour care for him at home with people who kind of understand that that is part and parcel of looking after Colin Bedil, and they sort of think it's funny at some level, but initially it's unbelievably shocking and very aggressive, you know. So that's part of the point, is that everyone has a different type of dementia. Dementia is, I think I described it on that TV show that I did, it's kind of a dark rainbow. And people need to understand it isn't just going to be this one way of dealing with it. And I think the care system doesn't get that. And emotionally, we're not quite prepared for it, I don't think.
David, on a broader point about comedy, you know, we're talking about bereavement, dementia, real challenging issues. And you're making the case very eloquently that we need to still bring some levity into it. It strikes me that in society more broadly, people are disinclined at the moment to take humour well. You know, if we look across the pond, you know, there's people whose skin is absolutely, you know, wafer thin. Mm. Is it a more challenging environment, or do you feel, you know, you've established yourself?
The first 10 minutes of my show are about social media, and people who think it's about my mum or my dad are slightly confused by that. But the reason it's about social media is that I think what's happened is that we now live in a time of taking offence, and comedy is a kind of central battleground for that. And the reason I think people want to take offence is that social media has done this thing of allowing everyone in the world to raise their own little flag of self, and something that really allows the wind behind that flag to power up is anger, because anger turns up the volume on who you are, and people want identity. That's what they want more than anything. And anger, outrage, confers identity. And a really quick way of doing that is to get, as happened to me just today, someone got furious about a joke that I posted on Twitter. I mean, arguably, their fury for once was actually justified, I thought. I'll tell you what happened. Because I did think, I don't know if I should do this. I'd taken a photo of someone. I'd very, very carefully made sure that he, or I can't remember if it was a he or she, I think it was a she, was not recognisable. On the tube last night, coming back from the show, it was a woman, I think, wearing a very big red top with a red hood. And I said, and I'm hoping this reference point comes to you, discovered shockingly today that the dwarf from Don't Look Now has got a bit bigger and is on the Northern Line, right? So it was generally liked by people, but suddenly this woman goes, I'm disappointed in you, David, which is very typical of the outrage. It's a sort of headmistressly telling off.
I'm disappointed in you.
So claim the high moral ground immediately. Because obviously a lot of this is about building up their sense of themselves and their own moral status. So I said, oh, well, I'm sorry, disappointment's part one of the colours of life, isn't it? So I tried to diffuse it. And she says, no, you should never bully people and blah, blah, blah. So I said, yeah, I deliberately made sure that her face isn't visible. I don't think there's any way that you would know who that was. Blah. And she keeps going with that and that. And my point is that you cannot do a joke now on TV, live, or definitely not on social media, without someone else getting offended by it. And that is why I begin by talking in my show about social media, because I want to say, okay, here's what I'm going to do to try and outflank that. I'm going to do jokes about my own dead mother and my father with dementia, and then who is going to tell me that that is offensive? Because I'm the person who should be offended by that. And it's a kind of dramatic sleight of hand to allow me to get into the, you know, very difficult subject matter.
On the issue of social media and an offence, do you get the impression that people are more anti-Semitic or more willing to be openly anti-Semitic now than they might have been when you were a kid?
Well, that's a really difficult question because, you know, it is a chicken and egg situation. I'm just trying to work out a joke about kosher and stuff like that. wouldn't come to me. But it's a milk and meat situation. But I think either, you know, anti-Semitism is all, we know anti-Semitism has always existed. It feels more vibrant now. It feels more there. But of course, the voice wasn't there before. I don't mean the pop show that they turn around on chairs. The ability for every form of extreme opinion is now mobilizable and articulable, whatever the word is, in ways that it was not before. And that has happened very quickly and in a very striking way. In my opinion, the only reason that Trump is there, the only reason that Corbyn is there, is because suddenly what listeners, you'll have to imagine me, I'm putting my hands apart from each other. So that is the spectrum of acceptable discourse on both right and left, which perhaps existed...
Your hands are sort of where your shoulders
are. Yeah, it sort of existed like 15 years ago. I think the existence of the internet and social media has meant the spectrum of acceptable discourse has now gone like this. My hands are now considerably wider apart. And the people on the far ends, they are the ones shouting the loudest because they're the ones with the most extreme opinions.
And they also know that... that opinion that they had, which they might have thought society frowned upon, they can see there are lots of other people that share.
Exactly. That confirmation, that's what I mean by mobilisation, really. The confirmation of your own extreme opinion by not, it probably isn't even that many people, but they do a lot of tweeting and a lot of shouting and a lot of memes and all the rest of it. And then they also have people in powerful situations. I mean, Steve Bannon, as far as I can make out, is essentially an internet troll who's in the White House, which would definitely not have been mainstream opinion not very long ago. It now is. And I think there is a definite relation between social media and that. Now, whether or not there's actually more anti-Semitism, I don't know. I do think, yes. I mean, I suppose what I think is, and this is not an original thought, that the normalisation of what would be very, very unacceptable opinions, such as Holocaust denial, for example, by it just being said a lot on social media and elsewhere, and people saying, oh, well, there's this point, isn't there, about something that is clearly a completely horrendous, appalling bit of fake news, for want of a better word, about the Holocaust, a made-up bit of nonsense, will suddenly shift and become something that is almost discussed as if, well, that's one opinion and there's another opinion.
Is there anything positive here then? Is it a reminder that maybe some of these things, whether it's about gender rights or religious rights or racism, that do we all get a bit complacent, do you think? Can we say, look, this is a good moment to remind ourselves we still need to fight for these things and they're not givens? You know, maybe our children's generation won't assume that everyone is viewed equally.
I don't know the answer to that, really. I mean, I know that there seems to be a lot of fighting going on now. If anything, there's more fighting going on now. Whether or not it leads to a place of harmony, I'm not sure. You know, it's really hard to judge, isn't it? Because a lot of, should you come see my show, and something else you may notice, is that the people who are actually getting angry with me, they are generally people who think of themselves as progressives. Mm. It's generally people who have got furious on behalf of some social justice warrior thing. I mean, I'll give you an example. I do a joke I did about Oscar Pistorius. And the joke is, it was when Oscar Pistorius was sentenced to serve some of his sentence under house arrest. I say, personally, if I was guarding Oscar Pistorius during the house arrest period of his sentence, I wouldn't drink much liquid before bedtime. Okay, meaning don't use the toilet during the night in Oscar's house. But then a woman called Daisy Rage writes, oh, I get it, it's funny because a woman died. I think, No, it's funny, it's a satire, because that joke is about how it's a miscarriage of justice because he clearly shot that woman in the toilet during the night. That's what the joke is, but she's not interested in the joke. She's only interested in the space the joke sets up for anger. And that bothers me as well in terms of what you're saying, because I don't know that all this fighting for rights is always in the right place. Sometimes it's misplaced.
Okay, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there.
Is that it?
I'm sorry.
I just got into my swing. You know, I'm just starting to shout and enjoy myself. Never mind, I've enjoyed it generally. It's been great.
Good. David Deal, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The show is called My Family, Not the Sitcom. It's on at London's Playhouse Theatre until the 3rd of June. If you're here in London, do go and see it. David Deal, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Steve, I've got a kind of a feeling it's time for tunes. Do you go along with that?
Fine.
Try this for size. This is what I got for you. It's new from former Dirty Projectors member Amber Kaufman. It's called No Coffee.
Love.
That was the sultry pop of Amber Kaufman there with No Coffee. And we'll be talking to the sculptor, Kristen Visbal, after this. For the past few weeks, a small statue in New York City entitled Fearless Girl has been dividing opinion. It's a young girl proudly staring out at the world, hands on hips, ready to take on anything, seemingly. And that structure, by the sculptor Kristen Visbal, stands in Manhattan's financial district, positioned opposite another icon of Wall Street, Charging Bull, the statue by Italian-born sculptor Arturo Di Modica.
Now, Di Modica is claiming the presence of the fearless girl is infringing on his own artistic copyright, changing how the furious-looking bull is perceived. Does he have a point? Or should the bull now retreat, tail firmly between legs? Well, joining us on the line now from Delaware to tell us her thoughts is Fearless Girl creator Kristen Visbal. And in a moment, we'll be speaking to the art critic Francesca Gavin. But Kristen, let me start with you first of all. I guess we should probably go back to the original commissioning of this piece. Was it always designed to be incendiary, designed to divide opinion, designed to tweak the nose, both of that famous bull on Wall Street and maybe of the establishment more generally?
No, actually, this was a very positive symbol. We were so excited about it, and the concept was a collaborative one that several women came up with. And the message was to say that women are on equal footing with men in the financial sector. And State Street Global Advisors' message was to say, we have a call for the increase of women, gender diversity in leadership for better decisions, for increased profits. And I actually take my hat off to them for coming up with such a unique idea and using a piece of fine art. Mr. Di Modica, I am so very sorry to hear that he's not happy with the piece. But Charging Bull has stood by itself for 28 years. There is room for both sculptures. This was a positive message of the inclusion of women in business. And I would hope that it would be embraced by the other sculptor. It certainly has been embraced by the women around the world.
And yet, Kristen, there has been other criticism of the work that this was, you know, it was financed by big financial corporations, that it's, yes, it's about gender diversity, but only in the sort of the very elitist world of Wall Street.
Well, you know, I created this work in the same fashion that I approach any other project. And frankly, I would disagree with that because so many women were involved in this committee. They called me up last November 30 and said, you know, can you make a little girl with her fists on her hips? This is not a confrontational work. It is one. If you look at the features of the face on the sculpture, she is just strong and confident and proud. She is not confrontational, and the message is not confrontational. Now, the message that is sent is interpreted by each individual viewer, but the message that was intended was one of collaboration between men and women in the most positive sense.
Kristen, I wanted to just ask you finally, we're going to talk to Francesca in a minute about art in the public realm and how it functions in that space. But would this make you think twice? I just wonder, you know, there's obviously been a lot of controversy and you argue very eloquently that there shouldn't be, perhaps. But nevertheless, would it make you think twice about high profile public works like this? Or would it just, has it merely sort of steeled you to come again and do more of the same?
Actually, I think this is very, very exciting what's happening. I mean, this is a historical fact. This little girl has created such hubbub around the world, and I think it's a positive thing. In fact, I would be more inclined to move in the direction of making large and wide and broad statements with art. So I find this very exciting. I find it very necessary. I have to say that the leadership of New York is going to make the ultimate decision about whether this piece remains or not. But I think that they, doing their job, they're going to represent the general public. And right now, we have over 50,000 women that have signed petitions for the peace to remain.
Kristen Visbal, thank you very much for joining us, and best of luck with your battle to keep your statue where it is. That was Kristen Visbal in Delaware. Francesca Gavin, one of the issues that she touches on there, which it would be good to get your view on more broadly here, is who pays for art in the public realm? This was paid for by an investment firm.
Well, most public art is, actually. And it's really interesting, the history of commissioning. It's very interesting. The bull, wasn't actually commissioned. It was placed there illegally as a comment on the financial market 30 years ago. And then you've got someone else coming in there. I think that's very interesting kind of contrast. And also, I will preface by saying I think her points about feminism and the representation of women are really important. In particular, also because there aren't that many women creating public sculpture. It's kind of a rare thing. Often it's like public sculpture is often commissioned largely by groups of people, often not necessarily with an art background, which would make sense in this case, for a space to make a wider public statement. The most obvious public sculptures we all know are usually monuments. So they're often relating to events like war, etc. That's the main historical referencing. In contemporary times, that's definitely linked more and more with advertising. Those awful cows and bears and weird painted lumpy public sculptures that for some reason people love around the world are probably the most noted obvious public sculptures people see now. So, but like it definitely isn't outside of the normal way that public sculpture has been commissioned and installed in spaces, which is usually done as something as part of a municipality or a commercial interest rather than necessarily something coming from a wider artistic one. And an example that's not like that, or at least tries not to be like that, is a fourth plinth in Trafalgar Square, for example.
Well, I was going to ask you a bit about this because I know you're interested more broadly in how we get wider audiences engaged with and interested in art, be it public art, contemporary art, I suppose, as well. And the fourth plinth example in Trafalgar Square in London is interesting. It's become a regular talking point. It's on the front page of all the newspapers, where it never would have been perhaps in years gone by. Well, maybe I'm just looking about with rose-tinted spectacles. Something's changed, hasn't it, in the way that the public narrative, the discourse around public art in the last, I don't know, is it a sort of post-Tate modern kind of thing in this country?
Well, definitely. Let's be honest, everyone is more aware about art in the past 20 years than they ever were before. The Tate Modern, I think, is the most visited place for tourism, not only in this country, but one of the biggest in the world. I mean, it's hugely popular, and that's creating a much more curious and art-literate audience. So when they see public sculptures, they still go back to the Carl Andre, is it art, is it not art argument. I mean, actually, there's interestingly a show coming up in Italy curated around the furore of the Carl Andre bricks. But I think that it's a more interested audience. It's a more curious audience. It's still quite judgmental within all of that, but I definitely think it's really important to try to create further ways of communication to as broad an audience as possible. Public sculpture is a form of doing that. Whether or not I think it's necessarily good sculpture or technically brilliant or necessarily making that fascinating a statement is something else. I think they try to be more interesting about it. But it's always great seeing things you shouldn't or should in public space because it makes you think about public space in a different way.
And this challenge of who pays for it and how it's paid for, obviously, you know, that has an enormous bearing on what actually gets made, doesn't it?
Of course. But let's be honest, what isn't paid for with vested interest anywhere in the world?
Oh, so you're such a cynic.
No, but it's the truth. I mean, listen, you look at every biennial and you could go look at that and you can look at every exhibition and there may be a truly honest desire to have something that isn't connected to finance and commerce. But actually, every money comes from somewhere. And unfortunately, artists have to interact with that. I mean, it goes back to the Renaissance. Caravaggio was paid for by some great old bishops, etc. It's always been paid for moments of power, so it's always reflective of power. And public art is the most obvious reflection of whatever ideology is in place at that time. So hence Stalinist big heads during communist Eastern Bloc days. I'm waiting for a good run of Putin heads. I'm sure that will arrive at some point.
They're being fashioned as we speak. What about the way that the establishment's interesting? You cite these historical examples where there were these great benevolent sort of regimes, well, sometimes malevolent, but they used to like to funnel plenty of money into the arts. Do we need a better engagement in terms of how public and private engage? In public spaces, does there need to be some sort of public body, or does that way madness lie, do you think?
Well, I mean, listen, those things exist. They do exist internationally.
Are they fit
in different
for purpose,
places,
though? I don't know, in New York, in London?
I don't know. New York is a different... I mean, there's amazing public art projects, particularly the Public Art Fund and Creative Time in New York. Creative Time do incredible work with with artists. But it's interesting. Often the public imagination gets obsessed with things that aren't necessarily commissioned by artistic bodies. They kind of, I can understand why this has been so popular in an Instagram era where it's an easy thing to take a photograph. And maybe it's also representative of an increasing desire for the idea of protest that seems exceptionally popular at the moment. You've just got to be careful. It's not like a Kendall Jenner Pepsi ad concept of protesting. And I think that's a kind of a really interesting statement. The idea that this sculpture in particular is being focused on, I think, says something about our interest in defiance.
Well, indeed, and to go back to that sculpture, you know, some of the criticism has been, well, look, this is, you know, this is a sculpture of a white girl in Wall Street, paid for by a financial firm that's had some bad PR in recent years and is trying to have some good PR. It's sculpture celebrating an elite, even if it is, you know, the women in the elite rather than the men in the elite, as normally is.
Yes, I would agree with you completely. And can I be really honest? I think it's hard to avoid that, but at least it's pro-women. Do you know what I mean? But honestly, it can be that kind of statement. And actually, if you look at the number of women represented in galleries, in museum shows, it is so small. So the fact you've got a female artist making a statement about the representation, I mean, if you look at the number of CEOs, we all know that it's not like a huge amount. It's only a little girl. It's not a giant girl. But I, you know, aesthetically, I don't think it's like either of the works are that fascinating. I think it's much more to do with other ideological questions that say something about contemporary politics and maybe also about contemporary space. I mean, all space is owned now very much by different institutions. We don't necessarily have common ground in a kind of 18th century fantasy way that once existed. That doesn't really happen.
Quite right. And even the longest journeys start with a single step. Bit of philosophy there.
That was beautiful.
Very good, isn't it?
Is that philosophy or is that a lyric?
Cod philosophy, or maybe it's from Led Zeppelin, I can't remember. Francesca Gavin, and before that, Kristen Visbel. Thank you both for being with us on the Monocle Weekly. Well, we've just been discussing the streets of New York today, but let's turn our focus now to a battle over those same streets that unfolded over half a century ago when activist Jane Jacobs took on the might of city planner Robert Moses.
Moses is known as one of the most controversial figures in New York City's history. His preference for highways over public transport and clearing out what he perceived as eyesore neighbourhoods are unpopular with today's more inclusive urban planners.
But he also had his opponents at the time in the 40s, 50s and 60s too, none more prominent than journalist, author and activist Jane Jacobs. She's the subject of a new documentary, Citizen Jane, Battle for the City. And in a moment, we'll be joined by the film's makers, Vanity Fair's editor-at-large Matt Turnauer and Robert Hammond, himself no stranger to urban renewal, being one of the founders of New York's Highline Park. Before we speak to them, though, let's hear a clip from Citizen Jane.
I think it's wicked, in a way, to be a victim.
Absolute power corrupts absolutely, and Robert Moses was absolutely powerful.
He wanted to wipe the slate clean, start all over again.
I say that you have a cancerous growth there that has to be carved out.
And we're joined now from New York by Matt Turnauer and Robert Hammond. Matt and Robert, welcome both to the Monocle Weekly. Matt Turnauer, perhaps if I can begin with you. First of all, put this in some context for us. Robert Moses was not an elected official, and yet he had enormous power to shape New York City, didn't he?
Yes, Moses was unique in that he is probably the most powerful unelected person in the history of the United States. He was a kind of a genius, really. He started in the progressive movement in the early 20th century, and as the aide to Governor Al Smith in the 1920s, he ended up being the person who drafted laws, and he was the best law writer of his generation. In the course of doing that, he wrote laws that created these corporations that were called authorities, and he made it so he could be the chairman of these authorities, and he wrote the laws so they could not be changed. So he became immune from elective power. He was immune from a sovereign public, which is, of course, the system in the United States. So he really stands alone in that. And he was interested in building and rebuilding the city and the state of New York, and he proceeded to do that throughout the second part of the 20th century, sometimes with disastrous consequences.
Well, and it was those disastrous consequences that inspired Jane Jacobs and others to try and rally against it. Robert, perhaps we can turn to you. You can tell us something about this extraordinary woman. How did Jane Jacobs manage to take on somebody who occupied, you know, as we were hearing from Matt there, such a seemingly, you know, untouchable position?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what's making the sadly, the movie even more relevant today in the United States, is that it's a story of a woman taking on the kind of power you think you can't beat. And she was able to beat it. And most people, if you know of Jane Jacobs, you know of her writing and you know of her theories. But what I think is really, what people are really responding to in the movie is also her activism, how she organized people at a grassroots level to challenge one of the most powerful people in the whole country and win several times.
And Matt, that's the really interesting thing about Jane, isn't it? Because she didn't just get a petition together. She didn't just have a little protest. This was a properly organized campaign that involved committees and meetings and pounding the pavements and gathering support.
It was very complex. And she was a great analyst, brilliant woman, who wrote a great and classic book, The Death and Life of Great American Cities, which was written in the 50s and published in 1961. So she had really come up with a new concept of what a city was. She understood deeply how cities functioned. And when she was confronted with these really outrageous plans of Robert Moses to tear down much of Lower Manhattan, the most famous parts of Manhattan today, Greenwich Village and Soho, were on the chopping block. Imagine New York City without those neighborhoods, which might very well have been the case. Jacobs knew how to address the problem by taking basically a multi-pronged approach. This was no easy thing to do. You really had to have a deep understanding of the way politics and the various types of bureaucracies interconnected. And what she did was organized people to short-circuit those connections. And that's how she found success.
Robert, I just wonder, it's telling, I guess, you already spoke about the relevance of this in sort of modern America or today's America. It strikes me that maybe the standard of discourse around these sorts of issues, you know, you'd like to think we're in a progressive time, you know, that gets better and better. Surely it's got much worse. I don't know. You look back, or am I looking through rose-tinted spectacles?
You know, the only thing that I think is good is that people are mobilizing. People are realizing you can't wait for everything for the government or for things to happen top down. And often I think what Jane said is the people literally on the street know better. You know, they literally, you know what's working and not working in their neighborhoods. And I think Jane was always skeptical of the conventional wisdom. And, you know, maybe that's what we need on both the right and the left is rethinking, you know, what does that mean? What is, from Herbert, what do our cities need, but what does our whole country need? And people can make that difference. That's why I find Jane so inspiring, is that she wasn't the expert. She didn't have the authority. But and what she urges us to do is look around and figure out what we can change.
And Matt, on that point, I mean, do you think, I mean, obviously, you know, you've made this film to, as a work of art and to tell a story about a certain time and place. But do you think that's how this film takes on a life of its own, when it, as if it's seen as an example of what can be done today?
Yes, I think though we made the movie about two characters who were important in the middle of the last century, from the beginning we saw resonances today. I don't think either Robert nor I were prepared for how resonant the movie would be in the context of a Trump presidency, kind of surprise emergence of authoritarian politics in the United States, which has not seen that for quite some time. I think the closest we came was probably some moments in the Nixon era, maybe the McCarthy era, but this seems to be much worse. because Jane was an effective activist and someone who is spoke truth to power fearlessly, she serves as a great example, not only as a kind of icon, which is incidentally something she never really wanted to be, but also as a thinker, a strategist, and a public intellectual. I think we're sorely lacking public intellectuals in the English-speaking world today, mostly in the U.S., so we'll take the blame for that. Jacob's revival, I think, couldn't hurt.
I just want to ask you both on this question now. How much do you think, when you look at the long-term consequences of this battle between Jane Jacobs and Rob Moses, and Robert, perhaps you might be good on this with your experience with the High Line, how much do you think that, you know, the Jacobites have won when it comes to how urbanism works these days?
Yeah, I think, I mean, one of the things that I think can be a mistake is using it. This movie is not meant to be about Saint Jane, or we should use all of her prescriptions that she wrote in the 60s for our cities today. They're very different. We have very different problems. A lot of our problems now are over-success. At the time, people were fleeing the cities. Now people are coming back to the cities, and it creates a whole new set of problems. And so I think if she were alive today, she would have a whole new set of ideas and of ways that we should be working on our cities. So to me, that's, if you try to freeze her in the past and it's all about just stoops and old buildings, then I think you've lost, you know, we've lost what she was really trying to say to us, which was, you know, look around what's happening right now and see what's working and not working and try to change that.
But Matt, that is the issue, isn't it? Is that, you know, there is still this constant battle about whether a city is for its people or not. I mean, that's essentially what almost every major battle about city development comes down to.
Yes, in this way, she's lost on points, I suppose you could say. Someone in the film, the political economist Saskia Sassen, says China is Moses on steroids. In this way, history has outdone him. But Jacobs clearly has won on theory. And she gives us two big lessons, I think, that we can take on and take up. One is skepticism, that we shouldn't just take the word of experts. And the other, again, is speaking truth to power. And I think because she took on someone who was seen to be indomitable in his time, and had a measure of success, great success really near the end, that she can be an inspiration today. And in terms of cities specifically, her notion, which was radical at the time, is that cities are networks of people and they're bottom-up places. If it's taken to heart by people, if more people are made to understand that theory, which is really the purpose of the movie in a lot of ways, I think that change can be effected. A lot of people just don't look at their city in a detailed way. So if she can inspire people to, as she says, get out there, look around, and while you're at it, listen as well, and start to understand what makes our cities what they are. It's not bureaucracies and politicians, it's the people who live in them. Then I think that some change can be affected. It's always incremental. In some places, it's easier than others, but I think it can happen.
Indeed. Matt Turnauer and Robert Hammond, thank you both very much indeed for joining us on the Monocle Weekly. And Citizen Jane, Battle for the City is in theatres from the 21st of April, and we strongly suggest you find a screening near you. And there we have it. That is your edition 406 of the Monocle Weekly. Steve, quite the show this week. I mean, indeed. It's hard to choose highlights from that little lot, isn't it? But I'm asking you to do so nevertheless.
Can I say Henry Rees Sheridan?
Obviously not. I mean, you can say it.
I think it was a great show. It was lovely to have David Deal on, who was also, I was a big fan of his in the 1990s. I'm still a fan now, obviously, it's clear to say. But he was a big presence in UK public life.
I don't want to give the game away, but for men of our age, Steve, and I mean, I'm a fraction older than you, but not much. I would go so far as to say one of these seminal comic figures.
Yeah, No, I think that's true. Like Newman and Baddiel, Baddiel and Skinner.
The Mary Whitehouse Experience. I'm going back a little bit further. Maybe that was, you probably weren't allowed to stay up late enough to watch that.
I don't remember that. Mary Whitehouse. Remember her? Anyway, let's not talk about Mary Whitehouse.
Besides,
I love the Sis and Jane film is brilliant. And also, I urge you to pick up your back issues of Monocle. I would like to say it's in The Escapist. I think it was in The Escapist that Matt Turner wrote a really, really lovely essay about Jane Jacobs and her fight with Robert Moses. So there we are. A little bit of cross promotion.
I like a bit of that.
The thing. Magazine that is Monocle.
Well, let's why don't we actively promote next week's Monocle Weekly. Tune in again at the same time or download at your leisure. But that's all for this week's iteration. It was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Antia Longo and Helena Jarit. And our studio manager was Toby Hammond. Steve, I'm sure you'll join me in thanking all of them.
Indeed. That's it, isn't it?
It's bizarre.
Do I just say goodbye now?
Remind the listeners who you are and say goodbye politely.
From me, Steve Bloomfield.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Goodbye.